From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Leg Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we look at the future of redistricting in Wisconsin and how it could affect the next decade of elections. Then we examine the use of the term Latino vote and look at how voters who are Latino impacted the 2020 election.
Let's stop using these labels that condition ourselves to think of them as defining of an entire group, and let's use the label to just accept it as one characteristic of a diverse group of Americans.
Plus, we learn more about what purple bipartisan solutions to America's healthcare system could look like.
My premise, really, is that each side has some value, and if we could combine something, we would actually have better healthcare. But absolutely, what we have right now is broken. I think we're beyond a tipping point. It's a breaking point.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Every decade, states around the country redraw their district maps. This process creates different legislative and congressional districts proportionately divided by population. But since it last happened in 2011, the redistricting process has become increasingly controversial. Gerrymandering is the process of dividing districts based on political preference, and it allows politicians to choose their voters. Gerrymandered districts have come to dominate legislatures around the country, including here in Wisconsin. These districts have allowed Republican politicians in the Wisconsin legislature to retain majorities in both the Assembly and Senate, even when their party receives fewer votes. So, will things be different in 2021? David Daly is a gerrymandering expert and author. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the future of Wisconsin's district maps.
Starting in 2021, states around the country will start the redistricting process. Just to start here, generally, how does that process begin? We collect information, of course, from the census. Then what?
That's a great question. We redraw these districts every 10 years in order to account for population changes. These districts have to be as equal as possible when it comes to the number of people in them. So we get the census data. You figure out how many people you essentially need in every district. And then the state legislature has the main role in beginning the process of drawing new legislative and congressional maps.
So in 2010, there was a huge surge in Republican-led legislatures around the country, in part due to something that you cover in your first book, Rat Effed, which talks about Project Red Map. Can you give us, you know, a brief description of what that was?
Sure. Project Red Map is short for the Redistricting Majority Project. And there were some really savvy Republican strategists who recognized after Barack Obama's historic sweep in 2008 that there was a potential path back to power for Republicans in 2010 through redistricting. They recognized that 2010, just like 2020, was a census year. And so all of these districts were about to be redrawn. And they stepped back and thought about it and said, well, if we controlled every seat at the table when it comes to redistricting, so like in a state like Wisconsin, if we could capture the Assembly and the Senate and the governor's office, we could draw any kind of maps that we want. And Republicans realized that was the case in a lot of swing states, right? That state legislative races hold this outsized influence because they can be relatively inexpensive to run a campaign in, but if you can control them, it gives you the power to draw these lines and to set the field of play for the next decade. So across Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, Florida, Republicans set their sights on capturing all of these legislative chambers and then the following year drawing districts that would give them an advantage for the rest of the decade. And indeed, it paid off, as you've seen in Wisconsin And as residents in all of those other states have seen for the last 10 years, those maps have held. Republicans have not lost a single legislative chamber in any of those red map states in 10 years, even when, as in 2018 in Wisconsin, for example, Democrats have won hundreds of thousands more statewide votes.
Yeah. What do these legislatures look like a decade later? Of course, you said, you know, they haven't lost any of these chambers, but has anything changed? Has there been any sort of movement from where they were, at least after 2011?
It's a really good question. And usually a gerrymander loses some of its power over a decade as people move or people die or new voters enter the electorate or politics shift and people's opinions change. And the really amazing thing about these maps is that they've barely budged. If you look at a state like Michigan, a state like Ohio, Wisconsin as well, Republicans are still really in the same catbird seat that they've been for the last decade. In Wisconsin this fall, for example, there was no hope among Democrats that they would take back control of either chamber. Their focus was merely on preventing a Republican supermajority and sustaining the veto of the Democratic governor. Wisconsin, of course, you know, 2018 elects Democrats to all of its statewide offices, re-elects Senator Baldwin, you know, a couple hundred thousand more votes for Democratic Assembly candidates, and Republicans still hold 63 of the 99 seats. So you're awfully close to supermajorities, even with a minority of the overall vote total. And that is the power of gerrymandering. It's the power of these maps. And it has not lost any of its sting over the course of 10 years.
One of the questions I had when thinking about, you know, the process of creating these maps, but also the impact, when we're talking about redistricting, are we simply talking about maps that govern the state, so the state legislative maps, or are we also talking about the U.S. House of Representatives?
You're talking about both of those maps. That's exactly right. And that's the power here. The state legislature in Wisconsin has the power to draw not only their own districts for the Assembly and the Senate, but also to draw the state's 8 congressional districts.
When we think about the redistricting process that's really about to occur, where do the two sides in a state like Wisconsin sit right now? As you mentioned, of course, Democrats in the state had worked to ensure that there wasn't a supermajority of Republicans. They were actually able to do that, so there isn't a supermajority. What does that mean for the redistricting process?
Republicans will control the process in the legislature. So that is where the maps will start. They will essentially begin as a piece of legislation. And what I would imagine happens next is that, like any other piece of legislation, it will head to the governor. The governor will veto that map and likely send it back to the legislature. The legislature will attempt to override that veto. As of right now, on strict partisan lines, Republicans do not have the power to overturn that veto, which would then send this essentially into the courts. Now, there's always the possibility that a handful of renegade Democrats could maybe break off, be promised really good districts by Republicans who are drawing these lines and talk them into overriding a veto. That, you know, sometimes happens in states. The promise of a good district can often encourage a member of the other party to support a map, even if it endangers his party as a whole. But I think the most likely outcome is that this gets pushed into the courts as a tiebreaker. And, you know, certainly conservatives now maintain a hold on Wisconsin's Supreme Court. So we will see how they handle this challenge. It's one of the reasons why Democrats had been focused so intently on the 2019 and 2020 Supreme Court races. They recognized that Republicans were likely to control the map-making process, that a Democratic veto would send this into the courts, and that potentially that would be where the next decade of maps would be determined.
It's surprising, I think, for some Wisconsinites to hear these conversations, in part because we are a very politically divided state. As you know, the federal election that we just held was decided by a very small margin. But then when you look at our legislative branch, it's incredibly Republican, despite us being a very divided state politically.
That's the power of a tilted map. These maps were quite intentionally drawn in such a way as to ensure that Republicans won a majority of seats, even with 44 or 45% of the statewide vote. They were able to control these big majorities, as many as 59, 60, right now 63 seats in the assembly, with as little as 45% of the vote. And that is really dangerous for small d democracy. What happens when maps are drawn that finely is that you draw lots and lots of uncompetitive districts. When all of the districts are that uncompetitive, the only action is in the party primary, and those tend to be low turnout affairs that are dominated by the base. So you get the most extreme folks from either side who have the advantage there. You oftentimes don't see contested elections at all, and that's bad for a democracy. This is what is so toxic about partisan gerrymandering. It severs the connection between voters and their elected representatives. A majority of people in Wisconsin ought to be able to change the direction of their government if they think it's going the wrong way. Partisan gerrymandering prevents that. It entrenches these folks. We elect our representatives for two-year terms for a reason, because we want them to be close to us. We want to be able to call them back and have some control if they are doing things we disagree with. And the impact of partisan gerrymandering is that these elections in 0 years end up reverberating for an entire decade. And the real result is that these lawmakers are able to elect themselves for the next 10 years.
This is Lake Effect on WUWM, and I'm talking to David Daly. He's the author of Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and Unrigged. It does seem as though this process allows a politician to elect themselves, to really elect their own voters to some extent, and they choose people who they know are going to vote for them once again. And something that we've seen play out is a lot of inaction during a pandemic that has killed thousands of Wisconsinites and sickened many more. The inaction, when we compare it to other states, even states that are completely run by Republicans, it's very stark. Almost nothing has been done here. Can we attribute that to gerrymandering? Because it seems like they're just trying to appease the most strict conservatives among us in this state.
I think you can. I think that's what gerrymandering does. Gerrymandering does two really dangerous things. First, it means that these lawmakers aren't accountable to the general electorate. So they don't feel any urgency or necessity to take action on behalf of the people, because they know that they're going to coast to re-election in these rigged districts no matter what. But the only people who they feel some accountability to would be the most extreme base of the party, because if they lose that most extreme base, then they can be defeated in a primary. So what you end up seeing are, attacks on masks and sort of all of this kind of, you know, base culture war turns into the only things that these lawmakers are willing to talk about. They become captive to the fringiest fringes of their own side. And that is no place to be in the middle of a pandemic that requires some trust in science and in truth. And it requires all of us pulling together to try to solve a deadly public health challenge.
Well, and right now it's meant a lot of people are dead.
And right now it means a lot of people are dead, yes.
There are a lot of concerns, I think, moving forward, especially in a state like Wisconsin, where it doesn't seem like there are a lot of checks on the power of conservatives. Should we expect that for the next decade, these maps will continue to be biased in favor of conservative Republicans, and that there really won't be any check on their power in the state of Wisconsin?
I think you're looking at a long time before there will be any check on the power of conservative Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature. They will likely be able to draw themselves a map in 2021 that perhaps is not as brutal as the one that has been in place for the last decade. The threat of a Democratic governor's veto will probably create, you know, a little bit more fairness. And the courts will at least provide the threat of some oversight. But as we've mentioned, it certainly is a conservative court. So we're not exactly sure how much oversight it will provide. I think that the best bet for Democrats in Wisconsin right now would be continuing to try to focus on winning elections to the state's Supreme Court and changing the ideological balance there. That might be the best strategy at a time in which these legislative branches are so out of reach that, you know, Democrats are left hoping that a majority of votes simply doesn't put them in a super minority. And that is no place for Wisconsinites, Democrats or Republicans, to be. A majority of people ought to be able to change their own government. And in Wisconsin for the last decade, that has not been the case.
Well, David Daly, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy.
David Daly is an author and gerrymandering expert. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up, we'll break down the term Latino vote and examine if it could be misleading. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In 2020, Latinos became the largest minority voting bloc in the country. And as votes were tabulated last week, one thing that was demonstrated was the power of the Latino vote. It contributed to President Donald Trump winning Florida, but it also helped President-elect Joe Biden flip a historically red state like Arizona. The 2020 election has forced some to pause and reflect on the use of the term Latino vote. The election results could serve as proof that Latino voters don't act as a monolithic voting bloc, and the term can be misleading. WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar spoke to Dr. Stephanie Rivera-Beruz about the term Latino vote, and she begins by explaining the complexities about the makeup of the Latino demographic.
The term Latino, or Latina or Latinx, as some of us might have heard it, is a pan-ethnic label. And it's a label that is intended to capture both race and ethnicity in certain respects, as well as a kind of broad-reaching country of origin. So when we're talking about what it means to be Latino in the United States, we're really referring to a very complex and wide range of identities that have arrived or have been in what we refer to as the continental United States in very different ways. And their relationships to the United States are also just as complex as their stories of existence in relationship to the U.S. So in broadly speaking terms, Latino seems to capture everything and nothing at the same time. And as one of the things we're seeing with this election is that those complexities are all the more crystallized as we're trying to track political and civic engagement.
These levels of complexity include level of education, the generational divide, socioeconomic status within that large demographic. And I'm hoping if you could speak to the complexity right here in Milwaukee. What does the Latino population look like?
So Milwaukee, Wisconsin is a really interesting place in terms of its racial diversity and ethnic diversity because it is a what we call majority-minority city. It is a city that by raw numbers has more people of color than it does white people. However, you would never know this if you looked at who's in power and who really runs the city of Milwaukee. Right, the diversity of Milwaukee is not necessarily represented across the board. And so what we see in Milwaukee is that we have a very large community that is predominantly Mexican. But I want to be quick to note that when I say it's predominantly Mexican, that doesn't mean that everyone is from the same place in Mexico or that they arrived to the United States under the same types of conditions, even if they have the same country of origin. Again, showing the complexity of these types of experiences. And then this is further juxtaposed to a very large Puerto Rican population that also has a complex relationship with their arrivals to Milwaukee, if we're just thinking about Milwaukee specifically. And you also have the presence of people from other parts of Central America and the Caribbean present here, even if they're not necessarily part of the majority. So here I'm thinking of folks from Costa Rica. I'm thinking of folks from El Salvador. I'm thinking of people from the Dominican Republic. I'm thinking about people from Cuba. And this is just of the cross-section of people that I've met, right? There's, I'm sure, many, many more. But they might not rise to the level of noticing or legibility because they're numerically just not as present. But that doesn't mean they're not here. And that's an important thing to remember as we're thinking about how people vote.
You touched briefly on how someone's country of origin can influence or impact the relationship with the United States. And I'm wondering if you could just speak personally as a Puerto Rican woman, how has that impacted your relationship to being a citizen of the United States or your civic duty when participating in elections?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because I think, I mean, my personal case, but what I'm about to say will also, I think, speak to something broader, is that how we understand people's relationship to voting generally is also a complex story. And so we can't not appreciate those complexities, right? And so with the case of Puerto Rico, for instance, I have a really complicated relationship to voting because I know that even though I currently reside in the continental United States, and I know that my vote in particularly in these elections in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, have great impact and matter, I also know that this may not actually have a good consequence for the place that I come from, which has been and continues to be occupied, colonially occupied by the United States. Does that mean I didn't go vote? No. But does it mean that I have the same type of experience as other people might to the engagement with voting? Yes, right? And these are parts of the complexities that I think this election, just generally speaking across the board, really missed to see on all fronts. And these are the complexities of what it means to be Latino in the United States. And so from my personal position, right, what it means to vote for me is very complicated by the fact that I come from a place that has never known sovereignty. So I don't know what it's like to vote under free and sovereign conditions.
Should we still be saying the Latino vote?
Excellent question. So I think we really need to be honest about what it is that we're trying to track with racial and ethnic markers vis-a-vis voting blocks. And this election and the last election and the election before that, right? Elections in general tell us a lot about how these terms relate to each other. And what we're obviously seeing is that there isn't necessarily a correlation between how we're thinking about the racial and ethnic term Latino and the behavioral patterns that we anticipated with political and civic engagement. And so if we want those things to actually be tracking what's happening on the ground, then we might need to really reconsider what it is we're trying to capture with these terms, right? Just like we capture them with, say, the white vote, where we're always doing cross-sections about what it means to be white, educated, lives in urban spaces, doesn't live in urban spaces, has college education, right? These factors seem to matter when we're thinking about something like the white vote. But when we're talking about the Latino vote or the black vote, they're just these conglomerates of ethnic and racial labels. But it's not clear that we have a good grasp on what they're intended to capture.
So what I'm hearing from you is not that we need to abolish the language of Latino vote, but maybe we need to add more layers of complexity and descriptors to that. So what do you think is a better way forward?
I think we really need to appreciate the fact that all politics is place-based politics. So race is always going to be meaningful in how we think about political engagement, but how race operates in its context or how ethnicity needs to appreciate the places in which people are engaging. So the fact that Milwaukee is hyper-segregated matters for how we're going to try and predict how people are going to vote, right? The fact that the Rio Grande Valley is economically disenfranchised needs to be part of how we think about how people in those places will vote. And so we need to appreciate the importance of place for how race and ethnicity function as we're thinking about voting, particularly in the context of how people engage with politics and whether or not they're willing to vote in the first place.
Dr. Stephanie Rivera-Berruz is a social and political philosophy professor at Marquette University. She spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar. Following the election, writer and journalism professor Fernanda Santos wrote an article about the term Latino vote for the Washington Post. In it, Santos explains where both campaigns went wrong when trying to capture the so-called Latino vote and what can be done to harness the power of voters who are Latino in future elections. Santos spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar about her article.
Last week, you published an article in the Washington Post where you say, right there in the opening line, it was hard to keep a straight face Tuesday night, which, you know, we all know was election night, as one pundit after another fretted about the surprising levels of support for President Trump among Latino voters. And your reaction resonated with many Latinos and Latino journalists. Why do you think that is?
What I ask you to think about and your listeners to think about is, imagine if for 30 minutes or for an entire segment on cable television, you were hearing political pundits talk about the white vote. Why did white people vote this way? Do you think there's a trend in the way white people are voting these days? You know, white people voted for Joe Biden this time. Do you think that the Democrats are now the dominant force among white voters? And we obviously don't do that, right? Because we accept and we understand that there is no such thing as a white voter. There are voters who are white. There are voters who are working class. There are voters who are college educated, et cetera, et cetera. But for some reason, we believe that the term Latino voters can explain and encompass every voter who happens to be Latino. And that is a hugely diverse population, hugely diverse. There is a little bit of everybody and everything within this group. So when there was, when I was writing this piece, that was the first thing that came to mind, was my, really my disgust at the fact that there were all these people talking about Latino voters without truly understanding what it means to be a Latino who votes.
So is it time to reimagine the way we talk about the Latino electorate? And in doing so, does that mean that we now abolish this problematic term, Latino voters?
Yes. Abolish Latino voters. Abolish the sleeping giant. You know, abolish all these phrases that we hear again and again and again every election season, and that serve to explain why a result went one way or it didn't go one way, you know. So I don't mind if you say voters who are Latino were more likely to vote for President Trump than Joe Biden. But if you're saying Latino voters, then I'm going to say you are assuming that we all vote the same way, that we are all a single block, you know, and it's been that way for as long as I can remember, mostly because while us Latinos can see the differences amongst ourselves, the people who created the label Latino voters, essentially white people, outsiders, people who are not part of this cohort, to explain this rising demographic group, have a very hard time understanding that this rising demographic group is in reality a group of Americans who have Latino heritage, or who were born in Latin America and then gained citizenship in the United States. That was the case with me. I'm from Brazil. I came here, married an American citizen, became an American citizen. Therefore, I am now an American of Latino descent. So when we vote, we're all Americans. As Americans, we represent various different groups, have various different histories, live very different realities. And this is how everybody, reporters, journalists, and just, you know, your neighbor should approach the choices that people make or don't make every election season.
Yes, of course. I mean, you bring up a very good point, Fernanda, that all of us as individuals encompass various identities, right? Like you just said yourself, I'm an American, I'm Brazilian, I'm a woman, I'm an immigrant. So tell me, Fernanda, which identity do you use to go to the polls?
I use all of them. And the way I make my choices is based on what the candidates are telling me. I think that for a lot of us who come from Latin America, what is politics is a lot about the issues, the topics, the platform that the candidates have. Are they speaking my language, so to speak? You know, are they, and I'm not talking about those, like, you know, Spanish language radio ads. I'm talking about, are they speaking about issues that matter to me? In Brazil, I don't remember ever voting, saying I'm going to vote for a candidate of this or that party. I would say I'm voting for this person because he's speaking about the stuff that matters to me. And I think a lot of Latinos vote that way because that's how they were sort of raised in the world of politics. And that's very difficult in a country like the United States, where politics is so closely associated with Democratic or Republican, to the point that in certain states like Arizona, where I live, you have to be registered to a party even to be able to vote in the primaries. So there's no such thing as, you know, not being registered to a party, but also wanting to vote. I mean, these two thoughts are incompatible. So I bring all my identities to the polls, and I go after the people who are speaking about topics that matter to me in ways that I think are important to me.
So what do you think is the takeaway here? What lessons can the media, political pundits, and campaigns learn from years of erroneously talking about Latino voters as a monolithic voting block? I mean, as the United States becomes increasingly more diverse across racial and ethnic lines.
We need to stop thinking of these terms, Latino or Black or Asian American or Native American, as defining of entire populations. Latino does not define me. It's part of who I am. Then does not define you either, right? A Black person is Black, but also many other things, because there is this stereotypical or preconceived notion of what a Latino is or isn't like, of what a Black person is or isn't like, of what an Asian American is and isn't like. Even this term Asian American, gosh, Asia is such a huge continent with so many countries that are so different. It's demeaning, and it's trying to squeeze a square into a circle. You know, you just can't do that. So let's stop using these labels as that condition ourselves to think of them as defining of an entire group as if they were all the same. And let's use the label to just and accept it as one characteristic of a diverse group of Americans that happen to have different ethnicities, different races, different countries of origin, different histories, different levels of education, different socioeconomic status, and on and on and on, right? And let's just accept that we are now dealing with Americans. And how do American votes, where it depends on where they live, what they are doing at that moment in their lives, how things are going for them, etc. So forget these terms as defining of all of us, and start thinking of us as individuals. And you can think of how my Latino heritage, or my the fact that I am from Latin America, I was actually born there, helps define who I am. But don't think that because I am Latina, you have figured me out, because you haven't.
Fernanda, thank you so much for speaking with me.
It was great to talk to you, Angelina.
Fernanda Santos is a writer and journalism professor at Arizona State University. She spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar about her recent article published in the Washington Post on Latino voters. Coming up next, we'll speak with the author of a new book on bipartisan solutions to America's healthcare system. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the latest Republican challenge to invalidate the Affordable Care Act. This has been another chapter in America's ongoing red versus blue battle in trying to shape the way we deliver and pay for health care. Since the late 1960s, the cost of health care in the U.S. has increased at a higher rate than the rest of the world. It's now up to over $10,000 per person, twice as much of what the rest of the world pays. Yet, despite the cost of healthcare here, we don't have better health outcomes. Republicans and Democrats have long debated what a better approach to healthcare is. Yet Dan Sem believes that the best of both parties' approaches should be combined into bipartisan action. His new book, Purple Solutions, explores what is hurting our healthcare system and offers pragmatic solutions. Sem joins me now to go through some of these concepts and starts by explaining our country's history in trying to reform healthcare from both sides of the aisle.
I think we've been at a stalemate for so many years with healthcare, which is probably why it's as bad as it is right now. I honestly think that what we have right now is far worse than if the Democrats were completely in control or the Republicans. But my premise really is that each side has some value, and if we could combine something, we would actually have better healthcare. But absolutely, what we have right now is broken. I think we're beyond a tipping point. It's a breaking point.
So can you briefly go over just the basic red versus blue approach when it comes to healthcare?
Yeah. So on the red side, the Republican end of things, I think there's a lot of value in having transparency and competition in healthcare. I'm an advocate that free markets have been a driving force for prosperity in America and across the world, and that it actually can apply in healthcare. Many people will say it can't apply in healthcare, but the reality is we've never had it. You have never gone into your doctor's office and known what things are going to cost beforehand. That's why you get those surprise medical bills. Right now, the amount that we spend on healthcare in the US is equal to the entire amount of revenue that comes in from taxes. So how are we going to pay for that? I would argue that the big problem in healthcare, the biggest problem in healthcare is not how we pay for it, but why is it so darn expensive? And I would say there's absolutely no control on prices. So I do think we need to empower us as consumers so that we can go where we want with our medical records on our iPhone. And we can either go to our primary care provider, we could go to Walmart, Walgreens, we could go to direct primary care. We can go where we want. We're empowered. I envision that, and maybe done with HSA accounts where we have money in our account and we stop using insurance, we start paying more or less cash from an HSA. That would change the whole dynamic of how healthcare is delivered in the US in a positive way. On the blue end of the spectrum, you know, I don't want to get into sort of the discussion of whether healthcare is a right or not. I think what we can all agree on is that healthcare is vitally important, and a compassionate society should want people to have good healthcare in some way, shape, or form. So I do think we need something universal. Call it a safety net, whatever you want. I think we need something universal. You know, the ACA could be some version of that. I think Joe Biden's talking about a universal plan. I think he calls it the public option. I would just argue that if we go that route, let's not have it just be one universal government provided care. Let's have tiers. So everybody gets a baseline tier. That's pretty good insurance. And then if you want to purchase extra levels or you want to not use it at all and pay direct primary care, you're allowed to do that. But at a baseline, everybody has something. So I'm in favor of using direct primary care, buying things without insurance, and having a mechanism to do that. I'm also in favor of having something universal. And sort of the details of all of that is what I cover in my book. So,
when did healthcare first become connected to employment? And is America unique in having our healthcare attached to whether we are employed or not?
Yeah, and that came after World War II. So, you know, after World War II or during World War II, employers were limited in terms of the benefits and the pay that they could provide their employees. So one way that they rewarded and compensated their employees was with healthcare. And there were other tax benefits at the time. So somehow after World War II, healthcare got tethered to employment, and really no other developed country other than say Japan does this. And I would argue this is very problematic. It's a burden on employers. I think because of the out of control cost of healthcare, we in America have gotten hardly any raises. You know, our compensation pretty much tracks with inflation because all of what could have been, you know, raises has gone into healthcare. Plus, it really hinders people from being able to leave their job, their sort of golden handcuffs. If you want to be entrepreneurial and start something, the first thing you think about, you know, me, I have kids. Like, I want to make sure my family's taken care of with healthcare. So I'll put aside my dreams of starting a company. So it just tethers people to their employer, and the employer is burdened with this big financial burden. It's a mess.
So financial burden is the key word, right? It's a heavy, heavy thing we always think about, whether it comes to paying bills or the cost of getting an appointment. So you mentioned before the problem with healthcare in America is not who pays for it necessarily, but the actual cost. So can you explain that concept?
Yeah, and I sort of tongue-in-cheek joke that what the president of the American Medical Association called the medical industrial complex, I joke that they must be happy that all we talk about is how to pay them and not how to control costs. So right now, since the late 1960s, the cost of healthcare in the US has increased far faster than the rest of the world. It's up to over $10,000 per person. Now, whether you're paying that directly or your employer's paying that or your tax dollars, that's how much it costs per person versus $1,000 in inflation adjusted dollars in say 1970. That's twice what the rest of the world pays. I think that we could easily control this cost if we had more price transparency. If you look at countries like Singapore, and I know we're not Singapore and maybe not the best model, but they have universal healthcare, but they have it where everybody has an HSA account and they just pay cash from that. They spend 2.5% of GDP on healthcare. We spend 18%. Now, I don't have any illusion that we're going to get down to 2.5%, but I'd like to see us with the increase slowing down and maybe decrease a little bit. If we can do that, then we can make it more accessible and more available to more people. So I think controlling costs, in my opinion, is a compassionate thing to do because resources are limited. $3.5 trillion is what we spend now. There's a limit. How much more can we spend?
And why are the incentives in our current system wrong? Because that's determined sometimes cost or whether you're covered or not, or whether a doctor is incentivized to give you one treatment versus another. How does this lack of transparency when it comes to incentives impact our system?
Because it's all a reimbursement-driven system. So we as patients have no idea how much things cost, and actually physicians don't either. It's not their job. So what happens is the hospital itself has negotiated prices for every procedure in what they call their charge master, which is proprietary and secret, and they've negotiated that with the insurance companies. So really, the whole pressure on price is just between the provider and the insurance company. Now, if the provider inflates prices as they do, then the insurance company will fight that, but eventually they'll pay it, but then they raise our premiums. So insurance premiums have continuously risen over the last 20 years. If instead of a reimbursement-driven model, we were actually the customer, we were spending the money, we would actually be listened to. Right now, we're not listened to. We are insignificant. And even the doctor is insignificant. The doctor doesn't know how much things cost. And I'm not thinking that they need to know. But if I'm about to have a procedure that's going to bankrupt me, it'd be good for me to know that because, you know, healthcare expenses are a leading cause of bankruptcies, and it's not the doctor's job to figure that out. But we should know what's coming. And now that the copays and deductibles are hitting, you know, $1,000, $2,000 a year, that's just not sustainable for the average American. So that's why I say we've gone from a tipping point to a breaking point.
Universal medicine, you know, quote, socialized medicine. Why do you think some Americans have grown so afraid of this term when you say it's possible to have both, like to operate in a free market and also have some sort of baseline coverage for everyone?
If we had some sort of baseline coverage, then you wouldn't see this abusive emergency rooms. And even if it's not an abuse, it's people that should be going for healthcare are not until it's too late and then they go to the ER or they're using it for their primary care because ERs can't turn you away. That's a result of the Reagan era regulations. So if we're providing universal care the most expensive way possible, let's provide it in a more logical way. And the only reason I sort of shy away from the term socialized is I do like the idea of universal care, but it could be provided by private entities. So it could be government sponsored, but it could be competing private entities to provide that. But I do like the idea of a baseline of universal care. Canada has universal care where the government only provides it and you're not allowed to go outside of that. I don't like that as much as what a lot of the other countries in Europe do, like Germany, Switzerland, where they do have that kind of universal care, but they let you shop for other levels of insurance or go outside. I prefer that approach.
Your whole book is based that we can have purple solutions, we can have free markets and publicly funded universal health care. But do you think that the political rhetoric has conditioned us to think that it's one or the other?
I think it has conditioned us that way, and it makes me really sad. I feel like in America, politics for us is like a football game. We're two different sides, and we're just rooting to squash the other sides. So I think, for example, Joe Biden is coming into office in January, he's probably going to try to bring some sort of universal health care. I personally think some version of that could be good. I might have a slightly different vision of it. But I also think forced price transparency and competition, some of what the Trump administration had proposed, is good and could and should be embraced by Democrats. So I simply want each side to recognize that the other side might have had something of value. They don't even have to view it as they're shaking hands and compromising. Just don't squash the good that the other side had, because even though you might hate 80% of what they had, 20% might have had some value. That's the closest I can see to get to a purple solution.
And how do you think the pandemic has really put so much of our healthcare issues in the spotlight? And also, has it helped change things even in the short term?
It certainly was straining our healthcare delivery system. I think the big infrastructure that I was a little bit critical of, I think when you have a big infrastructure and you have to support that infrastructure, you're going to bleed money. And they were bleeding $50 billion a month for a while there because of that. So, but I think the pandemic has forced us to think out of the box. So there's been much more use of telehealth. There have been a loosening of regulations because one of the constraints for telehealth was HIPAA regulations that prevented you from being able to talk to your doctor over Zoom, and regulations that prevent doctors from providing care across state lines. Some of that has been loosened. I think that's a good thing. And I've talked to a lot of practitioners on both sides of the aisle, and they think it's a good thing. So I'm hoping, and we've kind of forced us as a society to embrace technology faster than we might have otherwise. So I'm thinking maybe we can do a lot of our healthcare using technology, like telehealth. I do think, and there are executive orders from the Trump administration for this, to give us more ownership of our medical records so that it's not so proprietary to the hospitals. It's very hard to get your medical records from your provider and move somewhere else. I feel like we should have it and we should let other people access it. We shouldn't have to ask for that. So just being able to be mobile and flexible with where we get our healthcare, which COVID has sort of accelerated, I think that's a good thing. And hopefully we can keep some of those positive changes.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, COVID also highlighted lack of basic PPE, you know, supply, demand, also people after receiving treatment, prolonged treatment, crippling debt after fighting a battle with coronavirus.
Yeah, just the supply chain and all the issues of dealing with a public health crisis. I think we've learned a lot about sort of flaws in our system for that. So, and it kind of gets to how much of healthcare should be provided in a centralized way, maybe from the federal government versus more at the local level. I tend to favor more at the local level, but during a public health crisis, I think there's a logic for having it be more top-down federal. So this is at the balance of sort of two political views.
Well, Dan Sem, thank you so much for joining me to talk a little bit about Purple Solutions today.
Thanks, I enjoyed it. Appreciate you having me on.
Dan Sem is the co-author and editor of the book Purple Solutions, a bipartisan roadmap to better healthcare in America. He also serves as the director of the RX Think Tank and as the dean of the Batterman School of Business at Concordia University in Mequon. Sem will also be part of a WISPolitics.com panel this afternoon, focusing on possible post-election changes to healthcare. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.